Our guest speaker today is Dr. Alan Weinstein, the Archivist of the United States. It has been our privilege to welcome him to SAA meetings since he became archivist, and his addresses are one of the highlights of our meetings. There's no need for me to give a biography, so I won't do that. What I will do is show that we've made a special plaque for him with Maureen Dowd's now famous Archivists Are the New Macho Heroes of Washington, since it was to Dr. Weinstein and the archivists of the United of the National Archives of the United States who to whom she was referring. So to the new macho hero in Washington, I introduce you to Dr. Alan Weinstein.
Thank you, President Green, I think. Good afternoon, new macho heroes and heroines of Washington. And good afternoon to the rest of us. A folktale from the unmacho ghettos, decidedly unmacho ghettos of pre-World War I Eastern Europe, described a raggedy, an evidently impoverished elderly figure sitting on a bench in a town square when a stranger approached and asked what he was doing there. Waiting for the Messiah, came the immediate answer. Really, the stranger responded. And the town pays you for that? Well, yes, but barely enough for me to survive on. And how long have you been doing this? All of my life. So you're ill-paid and ill-maintained, but you must get great respect for your work. Not much, came the response. What? No macho hero you? Hardly. Then why, sir, in these circumstances do you persist? Look, stranger, the old man responded. All of your criticisms are true, but consider, the work is steady. With apologies to the late Irving Howe, who titled his memoir, Steady Work, and used this story, I submit this as the genuine archivist lament and should probably shuffle off the platform at this point after tucking my pens in my pocket protector as Maureen Dowd had me do in her New York Times column. Neither am I, nor is any other archivist at NARA, a macho hero simply for doing our job any more than I can claim to have become Alchemist of the United States when I was once introduced by my friend the archivist and librarian of Canada said that he was introduced as I wasn't the alchemist, what was it again? Anyway, there's another one, I'll think of it before the end. But there it is. Today, I want simply to bring you up to date on some of the work at the National Archives since we met in Washington last August, and to thank you again for the extraordinary support I've received from this organization and its members during a sometimes difficult year. I also want to acknowledge my colleagues at the NARA Regional Archives and Record Center right here in Chicago, many of whom helped plan this conference, worked for it. But can I ask you, for those of you who are still here, either the NARA people from the area and those who came from Washington, would you do me the honor of standing up and letting folks know who you are? There's got to be more than two of you, but in any event. Okay. I begin, of course, with another story. Each morning as I get to work at the National Archives building near the mall in downtown Washington, I walk past a simple stone tablet in memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, placed there at Roosevelt FDR's expressed wish as to what he hoped would become his major memorial in D.C. And I reflect on President Roosevelt's letter to the then archivist of the United States, Professor O'Connor, R.D.W. Connor, written in February 1942, shortly after the U.S. joined the Second World War. This is Roosevelt. "May I tell you how very much honored I am by your decision to elect me as an honorary member of the Society of American Archivists." How many of you knew that FDR was an honorary member of the Society? Well, Elizabeth, you would know. But there it is. At this time, this is Roosevelt still speaking, "and because of the conditions of modern war against which none of us can guess the future, it is my hope that the Society of American Archivists will do all that is possible to build up an American public opinion in favor of what might be called the only form of insurance that will stand the test of time. The Society can count on my continued support in the fine work it's doing. Always sincerely, Franklin Roosevelt." He was referring to microfilm. He decided that was the magic answer that would keep all the records safe and in duplicate copies if, in fact, God forbid, the war took an awful turn. "We will celebrate..." Now, the law creating the National Archives, as you know, was signed by President Roosevelt, who also created the first modern presidential library, which he deeded to the country. And in the year 2009, we celebrate the 75th anniversary of the National Archives and Records Administration. Since we last met, it's been a busy year, the National Archives. The mission of preserving all of the important records our government produces brings with it several challenges, to say the least. We race to keep up, we need to keep up with the fast-growing number of records, both paper and electronic, and the types of records, from emails to satellite imagery, that we have to deal with. At the same time, we must keep up with the technologies needed, not just to preserve the records, but to maintain their accessibility far into the future. I believe we're meeting these challenges. For example, we now are able to respond to requests for documents and records in a more timely fashion than just a few years ago. And we're constantly adding to our web site, www.archives.archives.gov, more of the documents that are most frequently requested by the public. Moreover, we've been able to move ahead with new and exciting initiatives, access initiatives, despite the limits of our appropriations, and we're making progress in this area with technology. The initial implementation of automatic declassification on December 31st, 2006, has presented NARA staff with a formidable task. Although 460 million pages, let me repeat that, 460 million pages of federal records have already been reviewed by the agencies and released by NARA under Executive Order 12998, sorry. No light here, that's all right. We have another 400 million pages. That's 400 million pages. They're waiting to be released. There are still 100,000 cubic feet, approximately 400 million pages, remaining to be processed for release by NARA. To accomplish this, we've reorganized. In fact, we've doubled the number of people assigned to declassification in our staff, and we've reshuffled other functions as well. There are several challenges to continued progress. The first are two sides of the same coin: the need for NARA to make available to agencies all referrals so that they can abide by the governing orders, intended deadline of December 2009, and inadequate NARA staff to accomplish it. On the one hand, we have this inexorable deadline that faces us every day. On the other hand, we simply don't have the staff to deal with it. While we've released 1.8 million pages of declassified records this fiscal year alone, our current work plan calls for processing 54,000 cubic feet of records for the referral center, an amount necessary if we're to accomplish our part in assisting agencies in meeting the intended 2009 deadlines. To date, however, we've processed only about 18% of the records, considerably less than needed to complete the work plan. Clearly, even with continued refinements of our processes, without either relief from the intended deadline or a significant increase in staff, we cannot process records fast enough, and I do not expect either to occur. Should we ask if she'd like to join? The most likely solution is continued improvements in our business processes and possible relief from the deadline. While some opinions for relief may become available, we must nevertheless confront and ensure that records are not processed without referrals, because that's against the law. We have to refer these to the agencies from which they come. That those who require referrals are prioritized to ensure the most significant records are made available first. Using the remote capture, archives capture, a project for digitizing classified materials, the presidential libraries were able to meet the deadlines for referrals of all 25-year-old classified textual material. I'm very proud of them. Now, it's no secret that NARA's arm wrestle with budgetary austerity in that we strive to do more with less. We strive to do much more with much less. We implemented a temporary hiring freeze last year, as some of you know. We cut back on discretionary funding. We've also had to make some tough choices in the area of customer service, such as increasing reproduction fees and temporarily reducing research hours, prompted by the need to stay within our budgets while meeting all of our fixed costs. We hope to return to our previous hours as soon as congressional appropriations allow, which I'm happy to say may happen with FY 2008 appropriations in the next several months. Even while taking these budgetary measures, we've been able to increase public access to government records. As I've said oftentimes, the National Archives is in the access business. Consider some of these yardsticks. First, let's look at Freedom of Information Act requests. So far this fiscal year, we have significantly improved our performance rate in responding to FOIA requests for federal records. From last October to this past July, we completed 87% of requests within 20 days, which exceeds our target goal of 85%. This rate is 6 percentage points above the 2005 rate of 81%. Over the last 2 years, nearly three-quarters of all FOIA requests were completed within 10 working days, half the time required by law. We've also taken other steps to increase and broaden access to the records we hold in trust for the American people. And I'm going to come back to this general theme of who these records belong to and what NARA's responsibilities are. Work is progressing steadily on the Electronic Records Archives, or ERA, which will eventually hold all of the electronic records of government and allow access to anyone, anywhere, anytime, well into the future, regardless of the hardware or software available now or then. It's a tall order. We're working every day on it. In the meantime, our online archival research calling, or ARC as we call it, ARC, now contains descriptions at the series level of more than 55% of NARA's holdings nationally. ARC can be assessed and be accessed on our website at www.archives.gov. To provide greater access to important and frequently requested records, paper, rather, we've entered into partnerships with several outside firms. I wish I had the time to describe the partnerships. They're very exciting. And recently we completed a successful pilot project involving Google, Yahoo, MSN, and the National Archives. A project which has moved us closer to the time when these and other great search engines can take internet visitors deeper into NARA's wealth of information. Significantly, in the next week or so, NARA will issue for public comment our plan for digitizing traditional records in our holdings, and I mean for digitizing all traditional records in our holdings. It contains proposed principles for ensuring engaging in partnerships to digitize and provide access to our holdings while always protecting the public trust and public interest. There'll be no flamboyant approaches to this. There'll be no shortcuts to this. We're taking our time and we're doing it seriously, and you will all see what we're doing before we do it. Other NARA efforts to broaden access have encountered resistance. NARA's Information Oversight Office, or ISOO, for example, is charged with overseeing security classification programs in both government and industry. As part of that mission, and ISOO is run by a brilliant public servant, Bill Leonard, as part of that mission, ISOO monitors classification programs at about 65 executive branch agencies and departments and independent agencies. And it's heavily involved in overseeing implementation of the presidential executive order governing the classification, handling, and declassification of national security information. Recently, however, ISU has attempted to resolve a dispute over determining the extent to which the executive order applied to the Office of the Vice President, OVP for short, whose spokesperson said earlier this year that the executive order governing classified national security information, did not apply since to the Vice President's office, to his office, since the Office of the Vice President functions in both the legislative and executive branches. You get all that. Several stakeholder groups, including the Federation of American Scientists, have lodged complaints about the unprecedented claim of exemption by the OVP, and ISU is required under the executive order to acknowledge and respond to such complaints. Meanwhile, the White House has stated that the President does not consider either his office or the Vice President's office to be an agency under the executive order. As for the National Archives, our position is simple. We continue to cooperate fully and courteously with all relevant parties to try and ensure a clear and consistent understanding as to how the order, the executive order governing this process of reviewing classified national security information, how that executive order applies to all elements of the executive branch. On the legal front, and I think there will be no, just as an aside, I think the constitutional theorists who talked about the fourth and fifth and sixth branches of government as far as their ability to deal with the Vice President's office over here and the President's office over there and somebody else over here, I think there's increasingly a recognition that we have, count them, one, two, three branches of government. And you didn't hear me say that. On the legal front, NARA faces several lawsuits involving records under the Presidential Records Act. Judicial Watch filed a lawsuit involving a FOIA request at the Clinton Presidential Library for various records of Senator Hillary Clinton when she was First Lady. The Clinton Library, like other units in NARA, responds normally to FOIA requests on a first-come, first-served basis. And we are dealing with the request for Senator Clinton's records in the exact same manner as other requests we receive. I should note that even after FOIA review, the records in question are subject to review by the former president and the current president under the executive order while being considered for release. Having said that, we do expect, I stress this, we do expect that Senator Clinton's daily schedules as First Lady, which has been previously requested by another requester, will be completely processed by the archives and ready for the next step in the pre-release process, the pre-release review, within months. So there is no special effort to stretch this out after the election. We're doing our job. We've been doing our job. We'll continue doing our job. Another group, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, their acronym, has filed two separate lawsuits against NARA in the past year. One seeks the White House entry records of the current administration that are managed by the Secret Service, but which have been determined to be presidential records. The case also alleges that NARA failed to take appropriate action under the Federal Records Act. The other case is a FOIA lawsuit for NARA operational records relating to internal deliberations about the staffs of these White House entry records, to the status of these White House entry records. We hope we have released some documents in this, but we've withheld others subject to the deliberative and attorney work product privileges. Both cases are awaiting district court rulings. And in the fourth case, the American Historical Association and several other plaintiffs have had a case pending for 6 years in which they assert that certain provisions of President Bush's 2001 executive order relating to presidential records violate the Presidential Records Act. I should note that the volume of records created during each presidential administration has increased steadily and measurably. For example, during President Reagan's 2 terms in office, the White House generated almost 44 million textual pages of presidential records. By comparison, in 2001, NARA took in 78 million textual pages of Clinton presidential records. And additionally, the Clinton administration generated more than 20 million emails. 20 million. We expect the Bush administration to surpass that figure in a stunning way. If printed, those 20 million emails would surpass the number of textual pages of presidential records generated by President H.W. Bush in his administration. At the same time, there's been an increase in the number of FOIA requests filed by the presidential libraries. Reagan Library, 100 FOIA requests in the first year that it was subject to FOIA. But at the Bush Library, Bush 41, 91 FOIA requests. Clinton Library, 336 requests in that same time period. The archival staff at the National Archives, however, has not increased in the newer presidential libraries to keep pace with these larger holdings. In fact, staff members have remained virtually unchanged. There are only 27 archivists at all three of these so-called presidential libraries to handle a considerable backlog. The Reagan Library, 1.2 million pages of backlog. The Bush Library, 2.2 million pages. The Clinton Library, 10 million page backlog. Now, I got to the point about a year into this position where I said, this is very demoralizing. It's got to be demoralizing to the staff. So what we're going to do now is we're not going to refer to this as a backlog any longer. We're going to call it, are you ready for this? I've explained to people that from this point on, we're going to call these things surpluses. We have a surplus at each of these libraries. And I've already started my discussions with Congress on their understanding that we're all dealing with surpluses now. I won't begin to tell you what responses I've gotten from people. However, okay. Turning to one previously vexatious matter, as you must know, previously private Richard Nixon Library and Birthplace in Yorba Linda, California, was transferred to the National Archives in July and is now known as the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum, with an appointment of my own historian Timothy Naftali as its director. As a result of this agreement and the transfer overnight from this oversight this summer, the 3 decades worth of contention over the Nixon tapes and papers has come to a brisk and relatively amicable conclusion in this new federally overseen library, accessible to all visitors, to all scholars, to all perspectives on the Nixon presidency. That's last year's issue. It's done. And if anyone tries to undo it, you'll see some interesting action. At the time of the transfer, we also made public on the internet, coterminous with the transfer, same day, an additional 11 and a half hours of taped conversations and 78,000 pages of previously withheld material, Nixon material. And there's more to come. The complete collection is going to be released in responsible order. As all of the records of the life of Richard Nixon are brought together, NARA will continue to increase access to them at the library in Yorba Linda, at our facility in College Park, Maryland, and on the internet. Many of the records will remain physically in College Park for the moment until we have a suitable facility at the Yorba Linda Library, which will have to be built. We're also making preparations for accepting the records of the administration of President George W. Bush on January 20th, 2009. We've already provided the Bush Library Foundation with our architectural and design standards so that when the library is turned over to the government, they will meet those standards. And so far, at least, there has been good cooperation on this process. I expect that will continue. At the same time, our 12 presidential libraries have developed a number of system-wide and bilateral projects that have included the Vietnam conference at the Kennedy Library last year. I don't know how many of you saw parts of that. It was C-SPAN covered it wall to wall. We have a forthcoming conference in mid-November at the Roosevelt Library on the Supreme Court and the presidency in the period from the New Deal to the present. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is keynoting that for us. Libraries have launched on the internet a presidential timeline as an educational device, a source of documents, photographs, video clips, and education-based activities. And I was a bit late coming to this meeting because I had to stay in Washington for the announcement by C-SPAN and the National Archives of a series of 12, and this was announced on C-SPAN yesterday morning, a series of 12 two-hour live programs from the 12 presidential libraries that we run in sequence from Hoover through Clinton. And these activities will bring together a huge amount of previously unknown material on the presidents. So we're rolling. People are actually in Washington beginning to know who we are. And I'm very proud of my colleagues on that score. The National Archives is committed to building a workforce that represents the public we serve. Indeed, one of the goals of our strategic plan commits us to recruiting and developing a diverse workforce to better serve a diverse public. In support of this goal, we're expanding recruitment through efforts to build close relations, awareness for archival careers among groups that traditionally have been underrepresented in the archives workforce. I don't have to mention who those groups are. You know. Most recently, NARA has established a partnership with the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, HACU, to help us recruit the nation's best and brightest to perform internships at the National Archives with the possibility of jobs in the future. This past summer, we were joined by 10 very talented HACU interns who performed internships in National Archive facilities throughout the country, here in Washington, or in Washington, at the Reagan Library, the Nixon Library, and here in Chicago at the Regional Archives. Many of these students have never considered archival careers. They didn't feel wanted in the archival world, which is shame on us. But now they do want such careers. And I'm talking not only about Hispanics, but those who may be working for us as well, but African Americans and other groups which have not been traditionally represented adequately in our workforce. They will be in this period ahead. After spending the summer with us, almost all of the 10 interns expressed interest in pursuing archives-related careers on a permanent basis, and one of them is already on his way, having recently accepted a position in our Office of Record Services in Washington. In addition to our partnership with HACU, the National Archives also works closely now with the Gates Millennium Scholars Program, a scholarship program designed to promote academic excellence and in providing opportunity for outstanding minority students with significant financial need to reach their highest potential. The Gates program is particularly interested in increasing minority representation in disciplines where minorities have traditionally been underrepresented, disciplines including library science. In support of this goal, the National Archives is partnering with the Gates program and with the University of Maryland in College Park, which we have a close working relationship with, to sponsor the program's first ever graduate institute this fall for scholarship recipients who are interested in pursuing careers in library archives or in information science. through this and other initiatives that we'll be announcing in the weeks ahead, the National Archives has begun to play a vital role in educating talented minority students about the value of archival careers. And I can assure you, we're not doing this for PR purposes. I can assure you, we're not doing this on a temporary basis, on a casual basis. We're in it for keeps, and we're going to change the nature of the workforce intelligently, and we're going to expand the opportunities for all Americans working at the National Archives. Some of you are beginning to think, how long are you going to be up there? What time's my plane? When can I get a drink? All of the important questions. Not too much longer. Now, back to the National Archives budget. We all like to talk about budgets. The Congress is working on all of the various appropriations bills now for fiscal year 2008, which begins October 1st, 2007. The House has passed a version of NARA's budget, and the Senate version has been approved by the Senate Appropriations Committee and is ready for floor action. Both of these bills increase substantially, I'm pleased to say, substantially, through the efforts of all of us in Washington and elsewhere, including Mike Heath, senior staff folks. Where's David? Is he here? Anyway, my congressional person is not here, but he's been wonderful. But in any event, I'd like to say a few words about the process of encouraging people to respond in budgetary terms. It's extraordinary that both the House and Senate Committee versions of our appropriations bill provide funding to allow us to restore the hours of operation on our research facilities to what they had been before last year's reduction. Let me repeat that. If the bills go through with what they have now, we can return to the previous hours of operation in the research centers, and we will be back in the situation before the financial crisis. That's why the fingers have remained crossed and will remain crossed for at least the next several months until Congress acts on the bill. At the same time, both bills, both House and Senate bills, restore significant funding for the National Historic Publications and Records Commission for NHPRC. The promise that I made when I became archivist that I would support and commit to encouraging an understanding in the administration of the need and the importance of NHPRC. I will keep that promise as many years as I'm archivist, as many years as anyone tries to defund that organization. It's doing too much good work, and we need it, and we're going to have it, and we're going to continue having it, as far as I have anything to say about it. The House version of the bill also includes funds, can't believe this, but it's there, to hire additional staff to process the huge backlog of unprocessed records. That's a new fillip to the whole thing, and if it stays there in the bill, it's wonderful news for all of my colleagues at the archives. But we'll keep you informed on that. In fact, we'll keep you informed of everything. As you probably know, you probably get bored with all the stuff that comes to you from the archives these days, but you'll get more of the same. You don't want to read it, just throw it in the circular file. But there'll be more. In other legislation, both chambers have passed bills creating a FOIA expediting ombudsman, what they call a national information advocate, to be an advocate for the Freedom of Information Act, to try to increase the number of things released, to try to improve the amount of time it takes to get them released. And both chambers have approved legislation calling for more reporting of donations to presidential library foundations, We'll also be talking to lawmakers in the House and Senate soon about legislation for NHPRC reauthorization, which we have to do next year. At this time, I would like to thank personally and humbly the chairman, the ranking members, and the staffs, especially of our two appropriations subcommittees. I'm referring to Representative Jose Serrano of New York, the chairman, Ralph Regula of Ohio, Congressman Regula, the ranking minority member. I'm referring to your great senator, Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, the chairman, and Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, the ranking minority member. But frankly, all of our congressional overseers, all of them, in both houses, in both parties, have been, and I'm talking about appropriators and authorizers alike. They tend sometimes to be distinguished. The appropriators were good, the authorizers were not so good, or vice versa. They've all been wonderful. They've all been consistently supportive of NARA's mission, of NARA's programs. They've done it the hard way by giving us the extra funds that we've needed in our budgets. And just on the off chance that one of them, a staff person perhaps, might be in this room, or that some of you will be seeing some of these folks, please tell them we said thanks and let's support them properly. As you know, NARA is operating under a new strategic plan that will take the agency through the year 2010. This plan offered major changes, some major changes, to earlier plans designed to make the National Archives an even more efficient, customer-oriented federal agency. I believe we have begun to make significant progress in the major directions cited in the strategic plan. I'm going to list seven of them. Solving the challenges of federal electronic records. Boy, is that a bear, but we're going to solve them. Eliminating the surplus, if you want to call it that, of unprocessed records, including classified records. Reducing that file to the amount of records that deserve to be classified. And I'm not sure that we've tackled that issue. Expanding education programs to advance civic literacy. I will give as much extra money as I can find, public, private, or a combination thereof, to expand what the archives has been doing there. And we've started in a big way, I think, with a $5 million contribution. No restrictions. We spent it the way we wanted, provided to us by the Boeing Company, whose generosity I cannot thank them enough for. It's put teeth into our program. It's gotten the interest of schools, and we're going to get, that's just the first of the big donations as far as I'm concerned. And if any of you in this room, any of you, have access or know somebody who'd like to jump into a wonderful program, have them come see me personally, and I'll do the pitch. But we're going to have education programs galore and up the gazoo. And this is a major function of the National Archives and will remain one in the years ahead. Okay, continuing strong leadership in federal records management, forming partnerships with non-governmental entities to further our goals, and one that we've taken on, as you know, in the aftermath of Katrina, which is actually proving to be self-funding these days, or we may soon do that, creating a major role for NARA in federal disaster response. That one we're also committed to. So let me end. I remind you that NARA's total holdings now exceed 10 billion, that's B, documents held in sacred trust for the American people. Sacred trust. It could not be clearer from our own mission statement, which says the following. The National Archives and Records Administration serves American democracy by safeguarding and preserving the records of our government. We're the first preservers, as I've been calling them, ensuring that the people can discover, use, and learn from the documentary heritage. We ensure continuing access to the essential documentation of the rights of American citizens and the actions of their government. Unquote. We will continue to safeguard these records 24/7 and live up to our responsibility to make them maximally accessible in a timely manner, absolutely timely manner, without exception, without evasion, without excision. You can bank on that. As Americans confront today's challenges, this archivist and his colleagues at the National Archives have a simple message for a simple message across time to those who have fought to preserve our liberties from the American Revolution to the present day. The National Archives, beginning in the founding days of FDR and Professor Connor, look to the Society of American Archivists for information, for ideas, for analysis, and for support. And they look for that as in the same manner as we at the National Archives do today. You provide invaluable friendship, you provide invaluable guidance, and I thank you for having invited me to speak today, to speak with you, always with you, not to you, to listen more than we speak. Well, you wouldn't judge it by what you just heard me do. and to learn. I thank you for your counsel. I thank you for your commitment to the archival and record-keeping missions. And finally, like others before me, I thank you, macho heroes and heroines of the Society of American Archivists. Keep your pocket protectors dry, and remember, the work continues. Thank you very much.
It's tradition for the incoming president to give a few remarks at the closing plenary, which I will do momentarily. And at the close of my remarks, we have a very small bit of business to do before we wish you well and turn you back into the streets of Chicago. So I'll just ask you, unless you simply can't stand it, towards the end of my address, to stay put for just a few minutes after it's completed. Incoming SAA presidents typically have taken one of two approaches to their mini address at the closing plenary. Some have introduced the themes of their presidencies and foreshadowed their presidential addresses. Others have used the opportunity to speak about something completely different, on the supposition that with so few chances to address the profession, one might as well get as many ideas out there as possible. I've chosen something of a middle path, one that looks at my presidential theme somewhat tangentially, or at least from a different angle than I plan to take at Archives 2008 in San Francisco. That theme is the identity of our profession, complete with issues of unity and divergence of union based on diversity. I have a long-standing concern that we've been worrying about our image in society and in our institutions, but have never settled some fundamental questions about how we see and define ourselves. During my 23 years in the profession and as a member of SAA, I've developed concerns about the identity and future of archivists and archives. It is that professional history that gives background to some, as my friends would say, strong opinions. Many of the issues that concern me have to do with the ways in which I think we inadvertently undermine ourselves and weaken or distort our professional identity. I feel an obligation to try to change those things that I see as debilitating the profession. My concerns arise because I love this profession, and more than that, I feel absolutely fortunate to be a part of it much less to have come to lead its national organization for a year. As I thought about how to present such thoughts, I remembered one of my favorite SAA presidential addresses, issued actually before I became an archivist and that I read during my graduate years. If you haven't ever read Maynard Bridgeford's Seven Sinful Thoughts, I highly recommend it. It was published in the winter 1980 issue of the American Archivist. Maynard's address was deliberately provocative. He spoke of the, quote, pathological and scandalous, close quote, avoidance of empirical research by archivists. He stated that archivists should accept that not all accession materials are worth extraordinary conservation measures. Instead, he said, we should, quote, let them rot, close quote. Sometimes being provocative is just what is needed to stimulate serious dialogue and possibly change current realities. So I mean to be provocative this afternoon as well. Now, granted, on occasion when I mean to be provocative, I wind up simply being boring. So there is that risk, but you know my intent. Acknowledging my debt to Maynard, I'd like to touch briefly on what I might call five frustrating foibles. These peccadilloes are not mortal sins, but traits to which we all, and I certainly include myself, may more or less often succumb. It's not that by committing one, we're no longer within the pale of the profession, but as a whole, I see these traits as diminishing our professional identity and our future. Number one, we're too resistant to change. Three different studies have concluded that our profession is composed of more guardian personality types than the population as a whole. A weakness of the guardians is that they tend to resist change. One can argue that we resist change in both large and small ways, but for the moment I want to look at our resistance to change in asking the small why questions about method and practice. As one example with which by now you're sickeningly familiar, why do we replace folders and paper clips while our backlogs grow? In this sense, we too often seem to be identified by our processes rather than using them as a means to an end. Processes are vital, but in constantly changing landscapes, they must be as agile and flexible as the people they serve. We become so comfortable with and sometimes so identified by our processes that we don't ask why we do things the way we do them. Or we do ask the questions, but it takes much too long to gain serious discussion, much less concrete testing and response. Take for a moment a tradition that is almost as old as the profession, the finding aid. Based on user studies, we are increasingly aware that our patrons find it difficult to navigate and interpret traditional archival finding aids. There's been barely a whisper within the profession about how we might reconceptualize or completely re-engineer this tradition to be more relevant to our users. Do we really prefer tradition to better user service? In an exception, Tom Hyrie and Michelle Light suggested a couple of years ago a concrete application of a postmodern concept, adding to finding aids the visible and explicit tracks of the processor and users to the contextual information presented about a collection in the finding aid. Take another recent suggestion for change. Joel Wuerl has posited ethnicity as provenance, a new way of relating to material generated by immigrant and minority communities. But where are the discussions of these ideas on the list, in the journals, or in our conferences? As one colleague has commented to me, quote, there are many exciting challenges ahead that should help us generate some adrenaline, develop some exciting new solutions, and allow us to test our ideas against the world, close quote. I hope that as a profession we begin to move further away from presentations and articles and list posts that are of the how we do traditional things traditionally variety. We need to move to more examination of our practice in the face of 21st century realities, such as backlogs and user studies, and intellectual currents like postmodernism and multiculturalism. We can be, and certainly at times are, bold and innovative as a profession. But we must make boldness and innovation hallmarks of the archival profession. Change for the sake of change is chaos, but change based on creative assessment of our mission and circumstances is energizing, inspiring, and essential. Number two, we still don't put our users first. One big picture change we continue to resist, I think, is the shift from placing primary emphasis on service to our users rather than on service to our collections. There remains a deeply ingrained cult of the record, I think, that insists that archivists are guardians and servants of the material, not facilitators and servants of our researchers. Although I could cite many articles that make a strong case for a user-centric approach to our profession, more compelling to me is the evidence that our resource allocators reward service to users, whether those users are internal to the organization or external, depending upon the repository type. Certainly, we are occasionally rewarded for saving or rescuing some collection or other with a high profile. But if we then turn around and put that material in our backlog where users can't get at it, the rewards obviously don't last. Even when it seems on the surface that it is our roles as guardians or auditors of records and recordness that matters, as in the recent dispute between Vice President Cheney's office and the National Archives regarding implementation of those security classification rules, what is at stake is not the abstract commitment to a set of records, but the ultimate ability of archivists to acquire and protect those records for access by the press and public, for purposes of oversight, and for purposes of an informed citizenry. Few of our resource allocators or constituents, I would argue, share or appreciate our traditional guardian mentality enough to support that role. This concern for users certainly includes processing and digitizing collections more quickly. It may entail finding ways to solicit user input into collection development and even appraisal decisions, as has been tried in Australia. It may entail having user interest drive prioritization of processing and digitization. It may even entail finding ways to permit users to annotate or add information to finding aids. If we wish to change the perception our profession has in the eyes of society and our home institutions, of dusty people caring for dusty boxes, we had better understand that what matters most, not exclusively but most, is our ability to serve users. Number three. Frankly, my friends, we whine too much. We must strive to be consciously and consistently proud and optimistic. Otherwise, our image in our institutions and in society will suffer. Our identity is unfailingly undermined and tarnished by our too willing denigration of our own profession. I realize that a certain amount of griping is par for the course within any profession, but after 23 years, I confess I'm frustrated by the extent to which archivists complain about their profession. Our status in society is not high enough, we will lament. Our bosses don't understand what we do and why it's so important. We don't get enough resources, and so on. Not that every archivist does this, and not that each of us hasn't done a little of this, I certainly have, but too many of us seem to spend way too much time kvetching. On what grounds do we complain? Society doesn't value us enough? How much should we be valued? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we get paid just about what firefighters get paid nationally. And a recent television news story on the New York City police noted that new officers make $25,000 a year. When next we think we're not valued enough, consider being paid less than we are and risking one's life day to day. Or do we miss the hero worship more than the money? We can't simply expect respect and visibility. We have to work for it actively and consistently. If our bosses don't understand what we do, that is surely not their fault but ours. If we haven't explained and demonstrated to resource allocators why what we do is so important, there is nobody to blame but ourselves. Perhaps we still have much work to do in better understanding what our resource allocators and our constituents really value, and in better articulating when and how we provide that value, very little of what we do is self-evidently important. We must accept that our fate and future is in our own hands, and that improving our stature requires strong advocacy, led by each of us at our own institutions and led at a higher level by the National Association, based on pride, strength, and clarity of message, rather than grumbling, weakness, and the assumption that our importance is obvious to anyone. Number four, advocacy is not yet fully integrated into our daily and professional work. It's not enough to be proud of our profession, obviously. We must more consistently project our strong belief in the importance of what we do and why we do it. In other words, we must steadily and staunchly advocate for ourselves and our values. We must do that as individuals, certainly, as we have in the recurringly successful campaigns to convince Congress to reinstate funding for NHPRC. But each of us must find other, consistent, grassroots methods of promoting and advancing both our individual institutions and mission and the mission of archives. Beyond advocating as individuals, we must also support our professional organizations' advocacy efforts, as we have begun to do more successfully, from testifying to Congress on the Presidential Records Act to presenting our position on copyright to the Library of Congress. These are activities that can be undertaken successfully only by organizations, and usually by national organizations, representing a collective voice. Advocacy must be part of our professional priorities, and members should be willing to support this work with effort. Effort can come by way of, for example, sections and roundtables identifying relevant advocacy issues, drafting position statements, and forwarding them to council for consideration. Council can't monitor all of those issues itself. We can also do more, I believe, by more deliberately working in conjunction with other archival and allied organizations, from regionals to COSA, from ALA to OAH, in articulating our concerns and priorities. It has been said that the most effective advocacy is when archival programs deliver what they promise and what is expected. What we promise must be more important and inspiring than acid-free folders, and what we deliver must be more than tidy boxes. We must advocate for a profession that has a compelling and clearly understood institutional and social purpose. Number five, we pay too much attention to the trees and too little to the forest. As one Canadian researcher noted about archivists in her country, quote, "As professionals, archivists are down-to-earth people who are comfortable with factual evidence and who subscribe, or perhaps more accurately, understand its values. The population at large has more people who are more focused on larger possibilities and see patterns and combinations which are possible rather than actual," close quote. One example, as most of you know, is that I think we are still too focused on individual items in a world of millions and billions of paper and electronic documents, photos, and other materials. This is a problem, however, not encountered just during processing, but during most stages of archives administration. We still too often appraise at the item level, what we call weeding, because we're worried about missing an individual document that should be kept or disposed of. Similarly, in the realm of digitization, where too many of us employ item-level handling and description, we are doing ourselves and our patrons a disservice. The University of Wisconsin system has recently begun using file-level metadata to speed provision of digitized materials to researchers. Given the demand by our researchers for more and more digitized material, why would we not quickly and broadly adopt such a useful and usable shortcut? We must acknowledge what Max Evans has characterized as, quote, "the seemingly overwhelming challenges of a society drowning in a sea of information." And that means we must be inoculated against the disease of mindless item-itis, close quote. These forest and trees foibles are emblematic of a larger issue for our profession, which is our tendency to focus too intently on the particulars of daily work and not intently enough on the purposes underlying our actions. We can and often do go on at great length about which kind of folder labels are most archival, disputing and comparing with almost Talmudic precision, yet less often seem engaged with the big picture question of our fundamental purpose. Let's think about our overall mission and goals more often than we think about which paper clips to buy or finding homes for everything we weed from a collection. We should follow Rand Jimerson's advice, quote, to confront the why questions in the field, going beyond the how and what of methodology and practice and the technical concerns that we address in our daily work. This might raise some fundamental challenges to our self-image as custodians, public servants, and technical experts, and confront us with the social, intellectual, and political issues arising from archival endeavors, close quote. As I will argue more fully in the year to come, our self-image must be broad, inclusive, and substantial enough to sustain us through this century. We must articulate forest-sized ideas about our profession if our institutions and society are to fully value archives and archivists. In his 79 address, Maynard Bridgeford was clear about wishing to avoid any kind of a Chicken Little attitude, and I certainly wish for the same. I speak of these five frustrating foibles not from a position of despair, but from one of hope. I hope my remarks will challenge people to think more highly of themselves, their profession, and their colleagues, and to expect more of themselves and of SAA. If we are united, proud, outward-looking, and willing to confront the tasks and changes that are core to our profession, I believe there is a future for archivists and curators that is bright and unlimited, both within our institutions and within society. At Archives 2008 in San Francisco, I hope to talk more specifically about a broad, united identity for archivists. For now, I suggest that we consider a vision of archives in which creativity should replace craft as we examine our daily work. Users should replace collections as we ask ourselves why we do things a given way. Pride in our role within our institution and society should replace prickly sensitivity to perceived slights. Advocacy should replace insular navel gazing about our practice. Commitment to professional unity should overtake the pull of fragmentation. And change is the order of the day. To achieve our potential, we must embrace change as well as collegiality, service, advocacy, diversity and unity, and certainly pride in ourselves, our association, and our profession. I look forward to sharing an exciting and, I hope, optimistic year with all of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. We have one additional gift, I guess you could call it, for Dr. Weinstein, which is being brought up to celebrate what we have learned to be a particularly important day in his life. We're pledged not to reveal where we received this information. I'm the last person to try and give a pitch key, but if you'd like to join me in singing Happy Birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear. Happy birthday.
Somebody left a pin here. I should say thank you, but I don't feel like that. There comes a time in all of our lives when we stop cheering the onset of a birthday and we begin thinking about what this means to us. Actually, no, I have to say, though, vanity overtakes all else. And this is just a thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. But I will tell those who gave the secret away that I'm not through with them yet. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
With that, I believe there is nothing left to say except westward to San Francisco and safe travels back to your homes. Thank you.